Officer Wyatt.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. It's Tuesday, August 6th, 2019. This is a periodic information exchange meeting between the North Dakota Public Service Commission and Otter Tail Power Company. Good to have you here. I don't have any opening comments. Commissioner Brian Crotchis, joined by Commissioner Julie Fedorchuk and Commissioner Randy Crisman. Commissioner Fedorchuk?
I don't have any opening comments either. Thank you.
Commissioner Crisman?
Ready to get started.
Okay, if we want to quickly go around the table and starting with you, Jerry, to identify yourself. And the other part, mics should pick up our voices.
Jerry Lynn with Commission staff.
Brad Tollerson with Otter Tail Power.
Mark Toma with Otter Tail Power.
Tim Rogelson at Otter Tail Power.
Bruce Gerhardson with Otter Tail Power.
Ryan Draxton, Otter Tail Power.
Okay, and then just if anyone else happens to come up during the course of the meeting and offering any comments, just to remember to identify yourself. It's for the recording, for the record, so it's all yours.
Okay, well, I'll kick things off, and we're going to do a little bit of a tag team presentation here today. But one, want to say thank you for this opportunity to come out here today. It's great to be here. Actually, I had the opportunity to stop in Jamestown on the way out. We are kind of finishing construction on what we call our fleet service building in Jamestown. So that's the building that we do maintenance on our line trucks. And so it's really we've got two. We got one in Fergus Falls, and we got one in Jamestown. And the old facility, which we've outgrown, was built, I think, originally built in 1967. And so I think we will continue to use that as our line crews, but we've got a really nice state-of-the-art fleet service center where our mechanics will be working. So they were pretty excited about that facility. So it's a good thing for our employees, and I think ultimately a good thing for our customers is the ability, especially when we get into servicing trucks and doing it efficiently, they'll go out. Also, like when we have a storm, a lot of times these guys don't get the credit, but they actually go out. We send a mechanic with them because equipment breaks down and so forth, and so they're on site as well. But they don't usually get the headlines like the linemen do, and so it was kind of fun to celebrate with those folks today.
It's in Jamestown.
This is in Jamestown. Yep. So, we've got a lot going on. I think our goal today is maybe go to the next slide here, is to give you an update on some of our major projects and then talk a little bit about the upcoming compliance for Coyote Station associated with regional haze. And, I'll just give an introduction here, but, obviously a lot we've been working on the last couple years, it's more than a couple years, it's probably about the last 6 or 7 years, is as we've worked through the retirement plans of Hoot Lake Station and developed the replacement options for that, we're finally at a stage where we can say we're in construction. And there's a lot of work that went in from the planning to the the permitting, the other development activities, the contract work, the legal agreements. And so we're excited to say that for both of those projects we're under construction, and that's a big milestone for us and a lot of work that has gone into that. Another project we're going to talk about is our CIS-1 project. That's our customer information system project, and that project we had, we expected challenges. We probably had more challenges than we were expecting, but in the end, it's going to be a good system for us. It's a needed system, and it's going to give us a lot of flexibility. And so we'll give you more detail on the execution of that project as well. And then, as I mentioned, finally, regional haze, and it's kind of what I'd characterize as maybe our next big item as a company, as we look to the future, and our generation resources, as we work through the compliance process for that, that's a big deal for us. And so I wanted to today give you an update on kind of how we see that process unfolding, a little bit of the timelines, and Mark will do that as well. But overall, if we're going to go to the next slide,
here, I'll go.
What's something I think is something we have a really good story, and there what we characterize is there's kind of three pieces to it, and certainly there's a renewable. So when we get done with the Maricourt and our Astoria stations and retire Hoot Lake plant, which will happen in late 2020, early 2021. 30% of our energy will come from renewable resources. We'll have seen a 30% reduction in CO2 levels from 2005. So 2005 is that benchmark when you hear a lot of people talk about it. But a thing, and you hear a lot of companies talking about that, but I think a thing that we're really proud of is the fact that we've been able to do it cost effectively. And we project that we will continue to enjoy roughly a 30% below national average rates, and that's on an average rate perspective. And so that's something that we, you know, it's really important to us that we are able to do these things in a least cost fashion. And I think that's a tribute to the folks that you see in the room here as well as everybody in our organization. And we work really, really hard to try and make that happen. And we're very, very proud of that.
In terms of the carbon reduction methodology, does that factor in the PPAs, for example, if you place a value on a coal-fired PPA, for example, in terms of carbon emissions, and then mm-hmm. if it's replaced by a renewable, or is that just on your own generation fleet?
This would be, and I'll let Mark give you the precise.
Sure. Yeah, 30% is an approximate number, but we really are focused on our own resources and then our long-term power purchase agreements that we know where the resource is coming from. So primarily renewables, but that 30% is reflective of a mass reduction. So in terms of total tons of CO2 2005 projected out to 2022. So intensity is actually not too far different, but this is meant to focus on tons.
Measured as tons, metric tons.
Total tons produced in 2005 by your fleet or your PPAs versus
correct.
Yep. Today.
Correct.
If I remember, you have 19 PPAs. Is that correct?
No, we have wrong? Relatively few number. I don't know, Brad. Do you know precisely?
You know, the key PPAs are the wind PPAs. So I think we have three of those at present.
I think I've got you flip flopped with MDU.
So as we, you know, as we look to begin the discussion around our projects here today, you know, just again, just kind of like to put out our vision statement in front of folks. And it's growth and success for our company as well as the communities that we serve. I mean, at the end of the day, we are really only as successful as our communities and our customers are. And I think we are committed to doing that. And I think a big part of doing that is making sure that we've got competitive low rates and affordable rates and provide them with reliable power as well. And so with that, I am going to turn it over to Mr. Tollerson, and he'll give you an update on how we're doing on our generation projects.
You want me to go beyond this one?
So, yeah, let's skip on to slide 6, I believe it is. So we're going to cover a few project updates. The first two, as Tim mentioned, are the generation projects, Maricourt and Astoria. Then we'll move on to the CIS 1. Go to slide 7, Bruce. So this is a map just to kind of orient you to where those generation projects are. Maricourt, I think the PSC has a long history of knowing where that project is, certainly in southeastern part of the state near the Ellendale-Edgley area. And then the Astoria Natural Gas Unit is in northeastern South Dakota, just kind of northeast of Brookings at the intersection of the new Big Stone South to Brookings transmission line, 345 kV line, and the northern border natural gas line. So it's right at the intersection of those two major facilities running through eastern South Dakota. Next slide. So Maricourt Wind Energy Center, just in July now, we closed on that transaction and have given notice to proceed to begin construction on 150-megawatt facility, you know, paired with Astoria. The wind and the gas will replace Hoot Lake Station along with some other expiring capacity contracts that are in place. The project will cost approximately $270 million to construct and operate, and lay down yards and some of the physical construction is just beginning this week. So we are right on the cusp of commencing construction on Maricourt. Next slide. So this table just provides some of the milestones. Mirror has clearly been in the works for quite a while for Otter Tail. We signed the original contracts to proceed with the project at the end of 2016. We're out here with the PSC in 2007 to obtain an advanced determination of prudence to assure recovery on that project. The generation interconnection agreement was finalized this spring, in the spring of 2019. And as I mentioned, we just closed on the assets and commenced construction this week. Ultimately, the project will be online by the fourth quarter of 2020, ahead of the PTC deadline for the first 100% PTC period of time. So that's kind of the update on MiraCort. I'll maybe pause there for just a second in case there are any questions on MiraCort before I move on to Astoria. Okay.
Just one curiosity. How long did the generation interconnection agreement take?
Oh, a long time. Too long a time.
Yeah.
You know, and it went through different iterations, too, in that there was an old original interconnection agreement that was in place from years ago that had ultimately been canceled or annulled through the process. Subsequently, a new interconnection request had been submitted. That was ultimately withdrawn once that old original agreement got legs through the court system. It is a multi-year process, and I can't speak to the number of months that it took, but it's been a very long time in getting the generation interconnection agreement for MiraCort.
I mean, I think if you go back to the as Brad described, we kind of have a unique interconnection in the sense that we were able to kind of resurrect an older one, but by and large, kind of tracking along that was the separate request that started like in the spring of 2016, and it. If we had continued on that track, we'd still be waiting for the final interconnection agreement. It probably happened late this year, I think
that's
current schedule. So it's been a long, difficult process, but we're very, very pleased with the result that we had with respect to
it. Did you have any upgrades that were required?
We did, but they are relatively small, in the neighborhood of $10 million of total transmission upgrades to bring MiraCort online.
So a big component of that is actually MDU will be building what they call a static VAR compensator, mm-hmm. a big piece of substation equipment right in that Ellendale area. And so, and then we've got a couple upgrades to do on our own lines, but that's by and large the scope of the facilities that we need to do.
Those static VAR compensators, they're expensive.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They are.
They're what?
Expensive.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Is it like a $9 million?
Yeah.
Roughly a $9 million.
Yeah. Right. So in the big scope of what you may be hearing for interconnection costs for projects, we are very pleased with where the MiraCort project has landed. You know, as we went through the various MISO Q cycles, we peaked with an estimate of $115 million at one point that we thought it could cost to interconnect MiraCort. So getting it done at $10 million, we're excited and very pleased at that.
Good.
Okay. So moving on to Astoria Station, this is the natural gas unit in northeastern South Dakota. You can see the range of capacity values. It'll be about a 245 megawatt unit in the summer months. In the colder winter temperatures, it'll actually be capable of producing 285 megawatts. It'll be a fast start natural gas unit on that major natural gas line, as I mentioned earlier. So it'll provide a good backstop, spinning dispatchable backstop to our wind fleet when the wind fleet isn't producing, or less expensive energy isn't available on the wholesale energy market. Project is about $158 million. We've backed out the transmission costs on that, so the overall cost to construct will be just under $158. Transmission costs on this are not high either. It's just they're going to be self-funded through the transmission owner process, so we've pulled them out of that number.
So the 245 to 285 megawatt,
mm-hmm.
for whatever reason, I'm gonna probably be 0 for 2 on this, although I double-checked and actually have a chart that has 21 PPAs. That was the number you had given me, Pat, a few weeks ago, but we can follow up on that later.
So there are PPAs for a lot of smaller resources on our system, and maybe that's where we're getting confused. We'll buy energy from a hospital that has a backup generator. We'll buy energy from a small wind turbine that's in one location. There are a lot of those very small ones. The major PPAs that we think and talk about are the major wind PPAs. So that's a good clarification.
Okay. Pat's not.
Does that tie out with?
Yep. Yeah. Okay, that works.
I mean, I think just if you look at those, you add those all those up, maybe 15 of the 21, it comes up to 10 megawatts or some small number, 8 megawatts. Yeah.
So Astoria, I think, was permitted at 250.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got some flux in the...
Yep, so the way the interconnection process works, everything is driven off of a summer accredited value, which is the 245 megawatts, so it falls under.
Okay.
Okay. So next slide, Bruce, is the time schedule on Astoria. Again, back at the end of 2017, we received the ADP from the Public Service Commission. This generation interconnection agreement was finalized at FERC at the beginning of 2019. This was slightly ahead of the MiraCort interconnection process. Again, you know, very, very small interconnections were ultimately required, basically just those facilities to tie the generating station to the transmission line were required. In May of this year, we started the civil construction in South Dakota. Expect the turbine. We've selected a Mitsubishi turbine to be delivered next March, and that will go through final installation with testing in the fall of 2020 and planned full commercial operations by early in 2021. So both of these projects are going according to plan right now. The costs are coming very much in line and favorable with how we anticipated they would, and we're full speed ahead on both efforts.
And then it's Hoot Lake Q2 of 2021, is that the...
So the end of May of 2021 is the anticipated retirement date for Hoot Lake, correct. Any other questions on those projects? All right, I'll pass it to you, Bruce.
And you thought I was here just to press the button. It'll be a little more than that. I have just two slides, and this is in terms of, like, the total dollar outlays, you know, smaller project than the two you just heard about. But it's, I would say, in terms of its impact on our daily operations, this one affects vastly more people within our organization. I know that you've already had a presentation on it that was in part on this in March, because you had a few customer calls that came in February and in March, and so we had a team of people out here to explain what was giving rise to it. It certainly was the likelihood was that this system going into service in February was a contributing component of what was causing some change. And change is hard, and change was hard for us internally as well as for some of our customers to see things differently. There were other factors, and I think if you went back to your notes from that presentation, you'd see that there were some actual weather impacts. There were some we were implementing new rates that were coming out of our last rate case, which we did a thing where we moved all of the costs of energy to the fuel clause. Historically, we would have recovered most of them in the base rates, and we moved those. So that those other things that were occurring at that same time were causing some of the customer calls. But nevertheless, you heard about some of this when they were here in March. But this the reason I have kind of just a screen to show you here of what Kayenta Utilities, which is the name of the company from whom we have acquired, you know, bought this system. That's sort of what a person on the phones or, you know, looking up information would see. And that's not so dramatic in and of itself. It really would have been what they saw before. And that was a green screen type system that had been built in the 80s. I think you've heard that story. So the real lift here was taking a system that was very, very old, internally constructed by or or programmed, I guess, by Otter Tail staff, and then using a commercial system, and then integrating that with all the systems that a CIS-type system has to integrate with. That is the challenge, and that is done. It was, like I said, went live in February, and now is functioning as we had hoped it might. In most respects, there is still some additional adoption and adaptation that we do, some of which is just getting our internal processes to work as the new system permits. So at any rate, the bullet points on the right-hand side of the slide tell you some of the things that this impacts. So the things that you are most familiar with are those things that the customer sees, the bill, the meters and the data that comes from the meters being calculated into a bill, the rates, those kinds of things. But there's also internal processes that benefit from this, mobile work management, workflow management, and that sort of thing. This will enhance our ability to do customer self-service kinds of things. But I want to give you the next slide, which is one sort of major application of the technology this permits. For internal operations. So now what you're seeing is a cell phone screen, a smartphone type screen that wouldn't be available to our customers, but rather is available to our field personnel. So those folks that are, maybe hooking up a service at a customer's residence, reading meter, whatever it is. So before this, we didn't have this kind of information. They had dispatched things that were more or less paper in nature, and they would use that information. Now they can make data entry right at the meter rather than running back to the truck, this sort of thing. This creates a lot of efficiency for folks. So you'll see service orders are completed at the meter, automatic resolution in the system. So there's a one-stop shop. You don't have to do several steps to get this into our central systems. It eliminates redundancy and data entry. It allows for some route optimization, which we're working through. That would be one of those operational enhancements we see as an opportunity for ourselves. And then GPS location on meters for ease in locating. So this is some of the internal benefits of this system. I think you had seen in the earlier presentation more of that account management. And this is what I came to talk about today, but I think that's enough. I'll move back to Tim, I guess. Or is it to Mark? Or should I pause and say, do you have any other questions on that before we go there?
Great photo.
That's a nice one.
What kind of feedback are you getting from customers on the new system? Any?
We had an initial set of calls right. we had a real uptick in calls, and it was primarily with respect to our North Dakota customers. So one thing we could tell from that, because this system changed the way all of our customers were getting information, but because we were having some additional things occur at that same implementation time, the change in rates and other things, we're trying to sort out which were related to the system and which were related to a combination of factors. There are a couple things that came out. One is that we have an opportunity to redesign our bill. We didn't do that as part of this transition, and we think that the bills that customers are getting from other vendors ours are not state of the art. And you know how bills can be confusing anyway when they have many, many components. So we think there's an opportunity. That was some of what we were hearing. I think that the system itself, most customers aren't going to see a lot of change right in what they see. This is going to be more for the person who might respond to them on the phone. Mm-hmm. The issues that we're seeing is how quickly can the folks that are responding on the phone get the information they need to respond to a customer. And I would say that we have been working through those operational things, which are, again, more at the personnel side than they are on the technical side, some on the technical side. And I think that we're going to be very happy with this once we get through those operational challenges of how quickly can I get to information that I want to give to customers, that sort of thing. So that's the kind of feedback I'd say we're mostly hearing is our ability to respond.
I mean, I think, you know, the backdrop a little bit is that, you know, we're fortunate that we don't have a lot of turnover of our customer service reps. And so these folks on the old system were very, very, while it was
sure.
technologically not the greatest system, they knew how to use it really, really well. And they could respond to virtually almost any question or someone within their group would be able to know how to get at it. Now we're challenged with the core functionality, the core things that, you know, probably cover 80% of the customer questions works, you know, our people do really, really well, but it's these unique things that's where they're still having to learn. So it's that slowdown. You know, probably one data point that I would share. So we survey the Bellamy survey is residential. Mm. Is it just residential or mm-hmm. is there some commercial in there?
I think it's just residential.
No, there's some commercial.
There's commercial, small commercial.
But we survey monthly 250 customers a month that have had a direct transaction with Otter Tail. So it could have been a call to our customer service center, or it could have been an interaction with one of our linemen or one of our service representatives. And so we've been doing this survey for many, many years. And, you know, we generally score in the, you know, kind of the low 90s out of 100 as far as kind of performance. And we saw when we hit that kind of that March, April, we dropped down to, I think it was 88%. And we now have seen it climb back up. And actually, at the end of June, I haven't seen the July results, but we were at actually 98. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, our customer service representative folks kind of had to endure a very tough time. But I think we've kind of turned it around, and I think both from a customer perspective and then I think from an employee perspective as well, feeling like, okay, I feel like I know the system well now.
Is that what? I'm sorry.
One more follow up on that. I guess I thought when we were first talking about this new system that it was going to have some abilities to have apps and more interactive stuff that the customers could use themselves. Is that maybe stage two, or you're not doing that yet?
It provides the backbone for those options, but okay. It doesn't in this of itself create an app or do anything that is direct interface to the computer or to the customer on their own computers, for example. But it is the backbone. It was the required first step.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Was the rough patch for both the printed invoices that customer received mm-hmm. and the e-bills as well?
There would have been some in each case where something had to be worked through, where there were unique circumstances associated with a billing, but that's an ordinary occurrence within just in normal ops. It would have been years ago that occasionally we have to have a bill pulled out because it appears to be an error and we would fix it before it went out, that sort of thing. Probably internally we changed some of the sort of the review processes for that, and so it wasn't as if it was ordinary course of business during this transition time, but I think we had you know, reasonable response to get the right bills were confident went out and those things. And if there was ever any error, there was a, you know, occasional meter read error, which is the kinds of things that happen in ordinary course of business.
I didn't honestly take a real close look at my bill.
Say that again?
I didn't take a terribly close look at mine. So I trust you.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And you should.
Somebody remind me. I keep forgetting. My yard light is out. So anyway.
Yeah, your yard light. Well, you have to call.
No.
You know, there are different customers look at their bill in more or less detail. So different customers have different needs for responses from us on those things. But anyway, that's all I have on CAS-1, unless you have other questions.
Sure.
Jackie.
Oh, this is John Hsu, and I'm assuming with the new system you're receiving just an extensive amount of data from your customers. How may that data and that information, how could you provide that to us in a manner that may help us as regulators? I'm sure there are certain thing processes you have to put in place or a certain way to aggregate that, but is that information that we would be able to access for the purposes of rate design or a number of other things?
Just to be clear, first of all, we haven't deployed AMI, so we don't have the kinds of data that utilities that have deployed AMI are getting, you know, regular daily time of use kind of data. So we don't yet, that would be a different deployment. This is the customer billing engine. So the data we collect, while collected a bit differently, is really the same data that we've been collecting historically, sort of like the customer usage over a period of a month, you know, what their bill is made up of, demands, if they are demand metered, that sort of thing. So there are, we don't have a growing body of data yet. If we do deploy AMI or something like the AMI, it could be that we have different granularity of data available to us.
Is that something you guys are looking at doing?
We're looking into it. I think most utilities are. I mean, most utilities have either deployed it already or are looking at it. There is optionality and convenience and efficiency that can be gained through automating meters, but we have a unique system. It's remote, and we're just not sure how it might apply and how it might be best deployed for us. Is that a fair answer?
Yeah, no, and I think that the key thing here, again, is we wouldn't have been able to deploy AMI without this system upgrade. So I think this, it's a very important system for us, but also somewhat of a launch pad for us to do some of these other things, and so some of the other customer apps in the future. But, you know, we're focused right now to, you know, make sure that this system continues to work and function as we initially intended, and then we'll work on what are the next add-ons as we go forward. So, all right.
We can move on to Mark.
Bruce, I just looked at the consumer contacts yesterday, and I think you have zero, so for the last month, or a very low amount, so the number spiked and it went away.
I appreciate that. Actually, it was a point of data I was going to give you, is that while we did have the spike in February, March, and a few in April, I think through April, I don't think we had any in May, any in June. There might have been one resolved, one in July, unrelated to this. So I think our your staff is probably happier with us this quarter.
Yeah. Right, Stacey?
All right, last topic of the day.
And does everybody know Mark?
You're not? Yes.
So Mark, great. Okay, I just want to make sure.
Mark Toma, Manager of Environmental Services for Otter Tail. So don't get out here often, but just enough.
Maybe you were out here a lot at the beginning or something. I don't know. I feel like
there was something called the Clean Power Plant where it was yeah. here a lot.
Right. That's right.
There was a time.
Oh,
yes.
The nightmares are coming.
Yes.
But you've missed North Dakota, haven't you?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, that's for sure. So I prefer the city, you know, maybe 50 miles north of your cup there, but that's okay.
Yeah.
That's
okay. That's why I've missed you so much.
Yeah, right. So regional haze, last topic of the day. I do have several slides on this. So hopefully it's informative. If it's overly informative, please just feel free to look at your watch or something, and I'll keep it moving along. I'll start off providing some general background on the rule itself, and then summarize the outcome of called round one in North Dakota, and then hit on the current status of round two. And so the goal of the rule is to protect and enhance visibility at Class 1 areas. Maybe if you can go back one slide there.
Do you want me to go back?
Yeah, you can do that.
The park.
Yeah, so at 156, what we call Class 1 areas, and that includes Teddy Roosevelt National Park. And so that's pictured here. That's actually a picture I took on my phone on a family vacation out to Medora a couple summers ago, and that's right at the Painted Canyon Visitor Center, about 10 minutes just outside of Medora. So just right along I-94, beautiful spot, and beautiful views, and obviously this is a great example of a day where it was not very hazy. So,
what a mess. Good thing we're going to get that cleaned up on some.
So this picture is not copyrighted. If anyone wants to use it for any reproduction purposes, go right ahead. All right, you can move on there, Bruce. The regional haze rule is a very long-range rule. It has this requirement for states to make reasonable progress towards achieving natural visibility conditions by the year 2064. And so it starts back at the year early 2000s. They established, you know, baseline conditions for each Class 1 area. And then the rule sets these milestones roughly every 10 years apart, requiring incremental reasonable progress towards achieving this final year 2064 goal. Round 1 covered the years 2008 to 2018, and really the focus there was on applying what we call best available retrofit technology, or BART, for most units that were built between 1962 and 1977. So that included, for example, our Big Stone power plant in South Dakota, and this was the rule that was the major driver for installing that air quality control system that went into operation in 2015. So as we now enter round 2, the period is 2018 to 2028. State plans are due in July of 2021, and I do have a more detailed timeline slide on round 2 activities at the end of my regional haze slides, so we'll get more into that. So why do we talk about sulfur dioxide, or SO2, and nitrogen oxides, or NOx, in the context of regional haze? And the reason for that is when SO2 and NOx are emitted into the atmosphere, it combines with ammonia to form sulfate and nitrate aerosols, and that's actually essentially what we oftentimes call fine particulate matter. And just like me, when I drink water, those particles in high humidity conditions will absorb that water and expand. So a lot of times when you get a warm, humid day, you'll notice more haze than on days that are more dry. So that's just a little bit of the chemistry and why when we start talking about potential additional controls for SO2 and NOx, why they get to be a focus at times for the regional haze rule. Slide 17, a bit of background on Coyote Station, because it is important again. Sometimes age does matter in the context of Clean Air Act regulation. So Coyote Station came online in 1981, began construction in late 1977. So it was outside of that BART window for round 1 of regional haze. Coyote Station was constructed originally with a dry scrubber and fabric filter for sulfur dioxide and particulate matter control. As you can imagine, it was designed to adhere to the regulations that were in effect at that time and are still in effect. But probably not surprisingly, the scrubber at Coyote Station is different than a new scrubber such as when installed at Big Stone would be. So, for example, Coyote Station currently removes about 60 to 70% of the SO2 and the flue gas, whereas a Big Stone plant or a new scrubber, you know, 90, 95%, 98% reductions are fairly common with a new scrubber. So, certainly designs have changed over the years. Coyote did install we call overfire air for NOx control in 2016. That was required as the state of North Dakota's reasonable progress requirement for the first round of regional haze, resulted in roughly about a 40% reduction in NOx at Coyote pre and post installation of that technology. And in the bottom there, the ownership breakdown of the plant, and as you're probably well aware, Otter Tail Power Company is the operating agent for Coyote Station.
Isn't there something sprayed on the lignite there too that helps to reduce?
We also inject, failed to put this on, we also inject activated carbon to control mercury there. That was part of the EPA mercury and air toxic standards rules from a few years ago as well. So we do have that installed, but that was left that off. That was not pertinent to the regional haze rule. Yep.
We on, Bruce?
Go ahead.
Yep, go ahead. So this is one slide in an attempt to cover everything that happened in round 1 in North Dakota regional haze. So if it's a bit convoluted, it's because it was quite the convoluted process, let's say that. So there, At the time, in 2008, there were 13 coal-fired electric generating units in North Dakota, and those were evaluated under the Regional Haze Rule. Seven of those 13 units were subject to BART. They were built within that 1962 to 1977 timeframe. However, the remaining six units were also still evaluated as part of the overall reasonable progress requirement. And some of those units subject to reasonable progress had to make some reductions. For example, I mentioned the Coyote Station NOx project. At a very high level, the breakdown between SO2 and NOx reductions in round one in North Dakota, four units were required to install new scrubbers, and four units were required to make equipment upgrades. Coyote Station was not amongst those units that I just mentioned. But in total, from 2008 to 2018, North Dakota coal-fired units reduced sulfur dioxide emissions by more than 70%. So some units made very substantial reductions. I mentioned Coyote Station already has an existing scrubber, was not asked to make any further reductions. But in total, substantial reductions within the state for round one. Nitrogen oxides, five units were required to install selective non-catalytic reduction, or SNCR, and three units, including Coyote Station, were required to make combustion upgrades. And in total, over that same round one period, North Dakota coal-fired units reduced NOx emissions by approximately 50%. So that's kind of the very long story, very short for round one in North Dakota. So moving on to round two, this is something that the Department of Environmental Quality is very busy with and will continue to be very busy with over the coming years. A lot of effort underway. I'd kind of currently described their activities as the information gathering phase. One big piece of information that they asked for from each power plant was something called a four-factor analysis. The four factors are listed there on that slide. It's a very technical analysis laying out what controls would be feasible to install at your power plant. Not any determination of what should be, but as more information is gathered, if reductions are needed, laying out what's available and the costs of those options, how long would it take to install those options, any ancillary impacts in terms of additional solid waste generation, etc. Otter Tail and the Coyote owners retained Sargent & Lundy for that analysis. The deadline, we did submit by the initial deadline of January 31st of this year. The DEQ did provide some minor comments on the study, so we addressed those and submitted a revised analysis on May 10th. So slide 20 gets into a bit more detail on what we call the technically feasible sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide controls that were evaluated in that four-factor analysis. So these are not just, there's a large universe of, controls or, concepts out there. This is boiling it down just to the range of options that Sargent & Lundy and Otter Tail and the co-owners believe are actually would be feasible to install at Coyote Station. And for sulfur dioxide, you're going to see a very wide range here. Capital costs estimated in a range of anywhere from $500 million to $325 million. So really narrows that one down. But the reason for the wide number there, as I mentioned, Coyote Station does have an existing scrubber, although we call it an early generation scrubber. So the lower end of that range represents if there's some just smaller upgrades to existing equipment that could be made, all the way to installing a new scrubber if reductions were needed similar to what were required at several of the BART units for round one.
Mark, could you characterize those as there's a lot of the really inexpensive ones and then it jumps way up to the really expensive? Or are there a range that kind of would
sure
lend itself to consideration?
Yeah, there is a range. Off the top of my head, roughly, we'll have points at I think there's $25 million. There's $128 million, $250, $325. So there is a range of options that fits under that umbrella. Yep. And it's all these options are part of this four-factor analysis, which the state has and is certainly a public document. Corresponding to that wide capital cost range, there's a wide range of just annual operation and maintenance costs associated with those options as well. So that's what the $2 to $22 million O&M bullet point represents.
And just maybe to clarify, those O&M costs are primarily reagents. So if Mark described how we inject carbon today, we'd be injecting other things, or maybe more carbon and more of other things as well. But that's a big component that drives the O&M cost. It's not we got, 15 additional staff to operate the equipment. It's really more of the materials that we use to operate.
Yep, that's the large component of that. For NOx, a much narrower range. There's only two feasible called post-combustion control options that are technically feasible for Coyote Station. So a narrower range, that 20 to 25 million on that slide, and then the correspondingly narrower range of annual operation and maintenance costs. So one of those options, for example, is that selective non-catalytic reduction, which was installed at several units in round one.
And how much of the NOx are you currently capturing or eliminating? Yep. 50, did you say?
So we approximately had about 40% reduction in round one.
Okay.
With the technology we installed. It's called pre-control technology because it actually prevents the formation of NOx, whereas these post-combustion controls will actually convert NOx to molecular nitrogen and water. So, and usually they work hand in hand with each other. But roughly, with SNCR, you'd expect another 30 to 40% reduction with that technology.
So if they require any NOx, it's going to be 20 to 25 million plus O&M, if they require any additional NOx reductions.
Yep, correct, yep. Really my last slide, and thank you for not looking too much at your watch. I appreciate that. Riveting stuff, I know. This is a, overall, as I should characterize as a tentative timeline. This was developed based on information provided directly by the North Dakota Department of Environmental Quality. They're great to work with. Obviously, every company is looking at this very closely and has lots of questions, and they graciously provided us with a lot of their milestones here over the coming years. The top of that timeline shows some of the key milestones of the DEQ through July of 2021, when that state implementation plan would be due to EPA. And below that are some of the ranges of time that a lot of the technical work is being done. Should just spell out there, so RAP 2028 modeling, what is that? So RAP, that stands for the Western Regional Air Partnership. So North Dakota, South Dakota are all part, and 15 Western states are part of this organization called RAP, and really can think of them as the technical support for states when it comes to regional haze planning, as well as other air quality planning for the Western region where there's common issues. So they'll take inputs from the state. They have the technical expertise and tools to do this really complex modeling, visibility modeling for each of the Class 1 areas. And then RAP will provide that information back to the state. So kind of what RAP is working on right now is taking the state's best information on what they believe to be projected for 2028 emissions in the state of North Dakota, and they'll be modeling where does that put the state's Class 1 areas on this reasonable progress glide path, and help inform the, and then state will take that along with the four-factor analysis and all sorts of other information and trying to determine what's needed for round two. So RAP is providing that information to the state, that source apportionment modeling. That's where they break it down in terms of what's causing this regional haze, you know, the components of SO2 and NOx, that's going to point more to, you know, power plant, or is it, you know, organic matter, et cetera, which is, you know, more localized sources or wildfires. So they'll break that down as well. You know, we anticipate the DEQ, you know, giving us a preliminary indication of what they might be thinking for round two towards the end of this year, assuming RAP meets their timelines. You know, I imagine it's very complex working with 15 states. North Dakota is on the ball and, say, quite a bit ahead of other western states in their planning. So certainly this could be subject to slippage some. But
so when you say western states, Mark,
yes.
Like what's west? You know, we hear we're in the Midwest, and sure. It includes,
yeah, it's
Ohio.
Yeah, right. It's yeah, it's North Dakota, South Dakota, and then you really just go west. So okay. You get to Montana, Wyoming. Yeah, Alaska and Hawaii are included. So it's a 13 continental, and then Alaska and Hawaii. So it truly is North Dakota and west when we talk about the western states. There's a Midwest, similar Midwest planning organization, and I think there might be five in the U.S. I could be wrong on that, but
so does our DEQ then have to come up? Is the goal to come up with something that, along with what the other Western states come up with, reduce the regional haze by an appropriate amount among all of them, or do we have to come up with enough to meet our, like, a North Dakota goal?
It's a good question. It's a North Dakota goal. However, each state is required to consult with your neighboring states, because, as you can imagine, you know, from an air quality perspective, there's not a boundary on your state. So, you know, North Dakota, if they are not on the glide path, what are the sources? Is it primarily North Dakota sources? What do we think the impacts are from neighboring states as well that have impacts, and vice versa? So neighboring states will be looking at, you know, North Dakota in terms of potential impacts. So they're required to consult with each other, but it is a state plan for the Class 1 areas within the state.
So I'm not sure that quite answered the question. So, for an example, not anything that's been announced, but tomorrow we hear a notice of a major coal-fired power plant in Montana is going to close down. Does that mean we go, oh, well, we don't have to do quite as much now because there's going to be less emissions in the West? Mm-hmm. Or does that not have anything to do with
it? So that will factor into this. The RAP is doing the regional modeling. They're getting they have a massive database where they're getting input from all the Western states, including Montana, that's building into their modeling, which will then, you know, it's specific to each Class 1 area, but it's going to take into account the emissions or the removal of those emissions from that plant when it comes into the projected 2028 position for Theodore Roosevelt on that glide path.
Okay, and it's so localized even more when MDU announced that Heskett is going to be shutting down.
Correct.
That
will factor into that.
Somewhat reduce the amount of pressure that's on Coyote, right?
This is all built into the model, so, you know, there will be less tons and less localized tons that go into that model.
So does RAP basically set a target then for each of the states or for the each?
No,
area?
So EPA will actually come out with, you know, they have the glide path again. It's baseline conditions and your 2064 goal, and you're connecting the dots of that line. Now, states are allowed to adjust that line based off of removing impacts from uncontrollable sources, from international impacts or wildfires, but it's a line, and so that target, that 2028 target, is really established by that glide path. It's not established by RAP.
So would you say the intention here is that once you get into May of 2021, common period will have been closed, and within some reasonable period thereafter, DEQ is going to tell you what you're going to need to do?
Yeah. It's a lengthy period with, you know, it's say, multiple opportunities for public comment. So their SIP development is a long process. They're required to, it shows up on their consult with neighboring states. They are required to consult with federal land managers before they even put their proposed plan out for public comment, which is scheduled there for, kind of towards the end of the first quarter 2021. But prior to that, we will have received those indications. And again, as early as end of this year, we'll get the preliminary indication. And then what's going to happen is once they kind of, they're going to give wrap, here's what we're thinking, please now model that control strategy. It's going to include the control strategies for all the sources in North Dakota. And then wrap will model and say, here's where that move, here's how much that moved the needle to get you on the glide path or not. But the state implementation plan, there's a long public comment period. They're assuming the public hearings will be built right into that. Ultimately, that goes to the governor for signature. And I do want to stress, this is the plan that gets proposed to EPA in July of 2021. State then, or EPA then has to take action to review and propose to either approve the plan, and they can approve the plan just specific for individual sources. They can approve the whole plan. They can disapprove for individual sources. They can propose to disapprove the entire state's plans. Round one was really a mishmash of approvals and disapprovals and multiple rounds of that. In fact, isn't complete for one plant yet in North Dakota. So it can be a long process. Hoping that doesn't play out again in round two in terms of all that back and forth. But EPA will have to review and then propose approval. That proposed approval or disapproval is subject to additional public comment. So there are additional steps even beyond July of 2021. But if schedule holds, we would expect compliance would be required by July 1st of 2028. That's the end of that round two. For example, Kyle Station's round one NOx controls, those were required to be installed with compliance demonstrated by July 1st of 2018. So it can be a long and winding road.
But is there a deadline on EPA to make a decision? Because, you're going to have some time to figure, now this is what we need to get contractors and do things.
Exactly, yep.
Do that within a few years. So what's their deadline?
They of course don't have a firm deadline. With that said, that 2028 expected deadline for compliance assumes there's enough time. So if one of the four factors is that time necessary to install the controls, so for a new scrubber that can be a 3 to 5 year process. It's a lengthy process. So if their approval starts falling outside of that range and that's what's required, we would anticipate needing to ask for more time to comply if it wasn't reasonable. We don't have to fit within that time frame if their approval were to drag out. But the way this works out, this should give them, if their approval can make its way through in the 1 to 2 year time period, it should fit within that planning. But said round one was hopefully taught us anything that it can take some time.
Be interesting to see who's running the EPA.
One of the challenges I think we saw the last time around, and I think it's true almost with any of these federal environmental rules, is that the legal challenges that, and this thing gets caught up in the courts. You may never get a decision, or you get a decision after you've installed, the equipment. It's a difficult process is maybe the way I would characterize it.
So the range I'm kind of hearing here is our best case scenario is $20 million, sorry, for those two. We don't think it's likely that they'll say, "Nah, it's fine as it is. Just leave it alone," right? I'm not looking for any gear. Just this kind of what your gut's telling you.
Tim and Brad have pressured me with that, and I've managed to hold them off. So I'm going to do my best to hold you off as well, there, Victor. Really,
push him, Victor.
Yeah. really, as you know, the DEQ is in this information phase, and without having the information in front of them, let alone me, it's I wouldn't want to be in a position to presume what the outcome could be.
Sure. Okay. And I have another one of those in a minute. But and then the high end of that would obviously be the $350 million. So that's kind of our worst case, at least. I mean, maybe we can get you to say that. You know, it looks like the total of all of those at the worst end of this is $350 million, which is nothing to sneeze at. But I guess one of my questions would be if we have a thought for what the likely scenario would be from them. Obviously, I know you're not the Department of Environmental Quality or the EPA, but you have some experience in working with these folks. You know, you went through the stuff with Big Stone, and I think we did a good job in that one. So do you have kind of a thought for what's the likely range?
I don't think my mic works.
It's good.
Clear as a bell.
Yeah, I've been pressured to answer that question quite a bit, and I really would hesitate. I think we're within a few months here potentially of having that initial indication, and
okay.
Probably the best time to get back to you with a response on what that is. But it's unfortunately, I think MDU heard we use this joke in their PI meeting, but I mean it is very hazy because it's not a black and white. Here's what you do.
Right.
EPA has promised states additional guidance on how to make some of these decisions and weight these factors, and it's been very slow in coming, and it has not come out. They're a long ways behind in issuing that guidance. So you've got the four factors. We're waiting on the visibility modeling. They're hoping to see some additional guidance here from EPA. So it's really difficult to kind of nail down predict where
it was a good dance. So, you know, this is what 427 megawatts, I think, is Coyote, and we're talking, you know, worst case about $350 million. How does that compare? I forget the megawatts on Big Stone off the top of my head.
It's approximately 475 megawatts.
Similar size, and that total was in that range. I forget the total ending amount. I know initially we were thinking like 450, but I think in the end it was
360-ish.
Yeah. So we're kind of in that range, and that kind of seemed to pencil out and make sense at the time. So I guess our hopeful that maybe at or even our worst case, maybe we can kind of pencil that out to that it would make financial sense to do that at that time. But what another concern I guess I have here is if memory serves with Big Stone, it's just you guys and MDU. No?
Northwestern Energy.
Northwestern's on that one as well. Well, here we have another party going on. Does everyone have to agree? Does all four parties have to hold hands and say we're doing this together? You know, what happens if one of them, you know, we get to the end of whatever the EPA and Department of Environmental Quality say, they say, nah, we don't want to spend that money. So I'm curious how that kind of scenario play out.
Yeah, I don't know that there is a simple answer to that question either. Certainly to move a project of this magnitude ahead, we almost certainly need a unanimous partner group to do that. But what the variations on that might be or what it might look like as this unfolds, I think is hazy.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. that certainly adds a complexity, and I think I think it's important that we try as co-owners to come together to a common position on it. But I don't think that there's anything that forces that. But I think we're certainly going to try and work hard to get to a common position with our co-owners. But we're just starting, you know. We're kind of understanding how the process is going to work, and then number two, then we got to, once we start to see some of the results come in, that will really inform then kind of what our options are. So it's, you know, I think everyone wants the answer about what's going to happen, but we're kind of early in the process, and I think, you know, the way we look at it, later this fall, early winter is when we're going to kind of get the first signal of what we might be up against there.
Do you have any kind of idea, you know, so how many more years without any major upgrades to the actual combustion unit itself does Coyote have left in it? I mean, it's not that old of a unit, so.
So So I think, I mean, from a book life, is it 2041,
I think, is the
it's kind of the
current
projected life. Yeah.
Okay.
It is almost 40 years old. I mean,
it is.
Young.
It's younger than me, which is okay, that's what I'll add.
Big Stone, they don't have to do anything in this round? Or does South Dakota have to?
So, interestingly, South Dakota has not reached out to us for any additional information or analysis. But I can say for North Dakota, the DEQ did ask even the sources that went through BART in round one to provide information if anything else could be accomplished in round two. So with that said, that is not my expectations that be additional controls, or if it would certainly, the controls are installed as a matter of just, again, is it, tightening that a little further. But a Big Stone plant is substantially further away to the nearest class one areas. I believe it's, around 300 kilometers away from a class one area. So that's my expectation. But
is Big Stone the only coal plant in South Dakota?
Correct. Yep.
One in the whole state.
Wait till that Astoria plant starts cranking. Watch SLP.
One other thought. Early on, you had mentioned there's 13 North Dakota coal-fired units. Is that only Otter Tail units, or you're talking all units in the state?
All units in the state. That was dating back to 2008. Now there's 11.
Okay.
Soon to be 9.
We can have them.
Randy, you seem to be on the cusp of asking something.
You said there's 9 now, right?
11, if I'm counting correctly. Yep.
So Stanton retired.
Stanton and 1 and 10. So when Heskett retires, that'll take 2 more.
You're good? Are you sure? Okay. Victor, any more pressing questions you'd like
to ask? No, I'm good. Mark did a good dance.
Don't feel bad. He does that for us.
Oh, thank you.
Jerry, anything? All right. Anything else from the company?
No. I think we appreciate the opportunity to come out and have this dialogue. Obviously, certainly the regional haze topic is an important one for us. And, the last slide that we have is our mission statement. And I think when we're faced with big decisions, we always go back to that. And for us, it's about balance. And, number one, making sure it's reliable, affordable, environmentally responsible for our customers. But then we got to make sure that our customers, shareholders, and employees, that there's a balance there as well. And so, we're excited about, what we've got going. We gave you that update on our Astoria and Maricourt projects, the CIS-1. We got a lot of activity going on for the foreseeable future. And I think go back to that, our rate position, and that's something that I think we probably don't spend enough time talking about. I suppose the time we start talking about it, we'll start to have problems. But it is something that I think that as a company we're very, very proud of and been able to do. So thank you.
Sure.
I did think of another question. So the costs of whatever this comes to for the western states, that gets spread around to all of your customers, even if they're in Minnesota, that's not in a western state, right?
Yes.
And so at the same time, are those states working? There's a region like that to the east of us that's also working on the next round?
Correct, yeah.
Do we expect significant costs coming from that region that are going to be experienced by Otter Tail that we should expect to have to apply to the North Dakota customers from the east region, or whatever they call the east region?
So specific to Otter Tail, are only coal-fired units that like plant in Minnesota, which we're intending to retire in 2021.
That's the only one you got.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. But these would apply. Do you have gas over there?
We have a very small 50 megawatt gas facility, which
that's the only one.
Yeah, okay. would not be impacted by this rule.
So you guys just set rates with us, and I think those were implemented about 7 months ago. Is that correct? And recently received rates from South Dakota as well. Are you currently in front of Minnesota right now?
We're not. We set them before coming to you.
Okay.
So those went into implementation in 2017, and we're evaluating right now whether to file again this fall.
Okay.
In Minnesota.
All right, and when do we anticipate that we'll receive an IRP from you guys? Is that in the next following year?
So we were originally scheduled to file our next one July 1 of 2020.
Okay.
We're contemplating right now trying to delay that 12 to 16 months just to get a better feel for what the impacts of this regional haze will be.
Okay. Oh. So within the next 12 months, you foresee that you guys will have any other filings with us aside from probably that possible discussion regarding the integrated resource plan? Anything rate related?
I think we do have a renewable rider filing in front of you currently. Is that right, Jerry? Do you know? We should have one in front of you for the Maricourt facility and a generation rider filing for the Astoria.
Okay, but we're not anticipating any new generation resources or not aside from the rider.
Other than these two, no. Right now, this is enough for us right now.
Okay. I think it's enough for us too.
Right? Yeah. So I think you've got what you've got coming. Yeah.
All right. Okay, speak now or forever hold your peace. Anyone else? Nope. Well, thank you. These are incredibly helpful. I always learn more than just a few things, and then you probably cause a little bit of work for staff because then I go back. And but no, really informative and incredibly helpful. So thank you for making the trip.
Good.
Truly do appreciate your time. I know you're all busy, so thank you for being here.
Thank you.